So this is Aisha Thomas-Smith doing an interview with Nadine Finch. It is the 16th of May 2017 and we're 131 Plimsoll Road, Arsenal, London. And this is for the GLC Story project. Hi Nadine.
Hi.
So first question is just, we're going to get into background mm-hmm. a little bit. So could you tell me how you would describe your background, a little bit about your history and your relationship with London?
Both my parents are from Ireland, but my father was in the Air Force, so they moved around the world a lot. So I've lived in London since I left university, and previously I moved around.
Okay, and what was your education like? You mentioned university.
I went to university at East Anglia, Norwich. I did English and American Literature. Later on I did law, but that was much later, after the GLC.
Okay. And what else was happening for you in the kind of late 70s, early 80s, in terms of your family or personal relationships or work? Or?
In the late 70s, I was working, running an Adventure Playground Association in Islington. Proves that I'd been, broadly speaking, a youth worker.
Okay.
And I was living, the late 70s, I was living in Islington. They had a number of housing co-ops because Islington housing was incredibly poor. And what the Islington Labour Party did in the late Labour Council in the late 70s was to buy up a lot of street properties and try to renovate some of the estates, but they didn't have the money to do it. So what they did, they formed tenants co-ops who took the properties over and renovated them to a certain extent. But also, I was living on an estate in Tuffnell Park because there was another idea to put young people on the estates, which were mainly elderly people. So we lived in Tuffnell Park Estate, Brettnock Estate. We were mainly youth workers, community workers, but we were put onto an estate of old people.
And what was that like?
It was good, actually. I enjoyed it. It wasn't a renovated estate, but it wasn't, the accommodation was fine, it just wasn't, no central heating, no, nothing like that. And that was quite good. And I was originally very involved in community groups, work around United Ireland, work around anti-racism, Rock Against Racism. And then I came to Labour Party in about 78, 79.
So that, yeah, leads us nicely into how you became politicised, or were you always politicised?
A bit like Jeremy, I was very political at school, actually. Mm. So I was political throughout the 70s, but not in any organised party. Mm. I've never been in any party apart from a party. But I was a trade unionist from around... Actually, no, I was a trade unionist in the early 70s in SOGAT, come to think of it. And I was in the NUT. So I'd always been in whatever job I was in, I'd been in my union. But in when I was a playground worker, we had a play workers branch in UP. And then in Islington, I've joined TNG, and I was on the one of the committees. And actually, that's a whole load of us then went into the Labour Party. But it was through community organisation and trade union movement, that's when people moved into the Labour Party.
And what was it that drew you to the Labour Party?
Because of the right-wing nature of the Labour Council here, which was very poor and very corrupt. It was controlled by the MP up here, isn't it, North, and a guy called Bayliss, who was leader of the council, both of whom were very corrupt, would say the Labour Party was full, so people couldn't join. And I could only join because I was a trade unionist, because they couldn't stop trade unions sending delegates to the what's called the CLP, the Constituent Labour Party. So at the beginning, which would have been about 78, there was only a few of us on the CLP, and we were all trade unionists, and we were heavily outnumbered, and it took us a long time to actually manage to let them get ordinary people into the party, younger people.
And how did you achieve that?
Very serious campaigning. It was quite interesting because obviously Islington was full of people being squatters, people in short-term housing. It had a huge amount of community organisations, and that was basically the basis upon which we recruited the Labour Party. And people, so these people were all people who had been organised in the community. They knew how to run committees. They were running tents organisations. They were running playgrounds. So they had the organisation ability. So when the SDB took over Islington in 82, 83, Islington lost all the MPs and all the councillors, just about. But we won them all back within 2 years, and that was through organisation. And it was a mixture of lay party organisation and our community organisation.
Wow, so once you were in, what were your memories of kind of some of the key events of the 70s and 80s? So what are your memories of Thatcher winning in 79?
That wasn't very good. I can't... I think we were shocked, but also we were intensely involved in what was happening here. So I think actually it probably didn't have as much impact on us because we were locked in this battle to democratise Islington. And in fact, in the 70s and 80s, quite a lot of things were very local. So people lost trust with the National Labour Party. So lots of people believe it's only possible to build up from the bottom and through trade unions. So we probably weren't, it was a problem, but some of the things that the Callaghan government had done, people couldn't support. So I think, I certainly remember that lots of people in the 79 government election didn't vote for the Labour Party. I won't name them because they weren't supposed to not vote for the Labour Party. They didn't. Especially because the local Labour MP was very corrupt and people weren't prepared to vote for him. So then it became, for me, it became very much a Benite campaign. And that would have started shortly after the 79 defeat, actually.
And what's a Benite campaign?
Well, Tony Benn's, people think about him only as a deputy leader. In fact, he was the leading person to democratise the Labour Party. And he worked very closely with community groups and trade unions. So, for instance, I remember chairing a meeting in Islington because I was chair of the local government committee, which is a kind of, it's a Labour Party committee which brings together the different constituencies in Islington. I remember him coming to Islington Town Hall, and this must have been about 82, and there's a huge meeting, loads of people came. People who weren't necessarily Labour Party people. In fact, my parents came, they weren't Labour Party. And that was interesting. And then some of us were down when he was going for deputy leadership, which should have been, was it 81? Yeah, that's it.
Okay. So how did all of this change when Labour won control of the GLC in 81?
Well, you see, I think it was continuing. I don't think it changed that much because some of the people I'm talking about who I was involved with, so for instance, Jeremy Corbyn, who's always been around on the left and very strong organiser, was very close to Tony Benn. He was my shop steward in the 70s. And we were both on the Greater London Labour Party executive.
And what's a shop steward, sorry?
It's like the basic organiser in the trade union. Okay. So you have regional people, but in workplaces you have somebody and then you have local organisers. So, and that was a big issue in the 70 shop stewards because before that they'd only had people who were remote in offices and lots of union societies had people on the ground, which worked very well. So the people like myself and Jeremy who were active were working with people like not only Ken Livingstone, other people like John McDonald and Mike, who was the economist person. So they were around in the Labour Party. So long before Ken actually won, or they won, people were talking about policies. For instance, to get our fight here in Islington to get a left person elected to the Great London council was crucial. It was a very nice bloke called Steve Bundred, because he was a kind of tipping point to elect Ken. So it wasn't, things were happening before Ken won, which Ken could then build on, because if you looked at the manifesto for Islington Labour Party, the council in 82, it had many of the policies that GLC went on to develop. And I'm pretty sure that Camden will have had the same as well. I can't tell you so much about some of the other boroughs. So, for instance, in the Islington Manifesto in 82, we had a police unit, we had a women's unit, we had race equality work. So the GLC was able to really build on work that had been happening in trade unions and community groups. And Ken was very good like that. He was very good at building on people's strengths. And when we come on to talk about GLC, I'll explain more about that. So it was obviously very good when he and the left won at GLC because of the resources they could command. But the ideas they were pushing weren't necessarily completely new. And they were able to build on. And the London Labour Party policy also dictated what the GLC did.
Okay, so how did you become involved in the GLC?
Well, I was, because I was on the London Labour Party executive, which created a manifesto for the GLC. I was involved in that way, but I was working in Haringey, and I'd been doing lots of work on women's issues there, but then I created a women's unit, and which wasn't really what I did in Bedfordshire. So I was wanted to move really. Now I was sitting on the platform at London Labour Party conference between Jeremy Corbyn and a guy called Narendra Mukherjee, and they produced this advert saying, "Oh, there's these jobs in the GLC. Why don't you apply?" So I did. So when I hadn't actively looked for a job, but this came along. And it was in what was called a programme office, which was the... It wasn't creation of Kent, it had always been there, which is quite a good thing. So it was an office which made sure that the elected council kept its manifesto promises. But it was obviously like different under Ken. So we each, a team each had... I had race, women's and policing. But you had to audit them for legal and financial as well as policy things. And it was a very powerful office because some of the councillors weren't actually very left-wing. Mm-hmm. And you had to slightly remind them what their manifesto was. And in one, I might have told this before, in one classic police committee, this guy from Newham, who was quite a nice old bloke, but not very sympathetic, and Ken had given him football as his area of interest, which he really liked, so he'd vote along with Ken. But he got asked a question by the Tories, and he'd said, "Oh, no, she told me to say that." No.
So are there any kind of accountability bodies like that with the GLA today?
No. Well, I don't think so. The GLA... Well, the Assembly's elected, but the London Labour Party, as many other bits of party, were stripped of their powers under Kinnockend. So there is a London Labour Party, but it's actually, it doesn't have the power that we used to have. So in that way, it's not accountable. They're accountable at the ballot box every 4 years, but they're not accountable in terms of manifesting the way they were.
So you mentioned the areas you worked on.
Yeah.
Could you go into a bit more detail about what that involved?
Well, so we'd work closely with whoever was the chair of each committee, and there was a monthly meeting of that committee, and you'd have reports to that committee, and you'd be checking with the finance and the legal people that what they wanted to do was doable. And what quite surprised me, actually, because I'd worked in local government before, is that actually the the old guard, we kept all the lawyers and the finance people on the whole. A few of them resigned, but mostly didn't. But they were quite excited to be doing new things. And they were really helpful. And that was a strength, because obviously they had years of experience in finance and legal affairs, which we didn't necessarily have. And they were usually very, very helpful. And so you'd make sure by the time you got to committee, everything was watertight. I have to say that I think the Women's Committee was the weakest one, and the Women's Unit was the weakest one. It was, I don't want to name names, they lacked a strong, they were too disparate, and they didn't really have as political a focus as the other two units did. I mean, race should have been a much more difficult unit because, what's its face? I'll come back to me. The man who was running it, he's very good, faced potential, most race units in London at that time had a lot of inter-racial problems, a lot of rivalries between different religions or different, like Africans against African Caribbeans or Indians against Pakistanis, but there's nothing of that because it was incredibly well run. And they were the first place ever to have an Irish unit and a Travellers unit. And that was accepted by all the other people in the race unit. And if there were, and that there were a few arguments, it was always behind closed doors. And nobody ever in public disputed, which was really good. So it meant they could have serious discussions about what they thought, where they were going, but they never, it was Herman Ouseley, that's what Herman Ouseley, he was a very good unit leader. And the police unit was incredibly well run as well. And given those two units had the most flack, I mean, there's jokes about the women's unit, but actually the most flack and the most threats, and there were threats. There was a fire actually in the race unit, a firebomb at one time. And some of the correspondence was really vitriolic, but it was mainly, particularly against the Irish unit, and the race unit and the police unit. But they managed to do very good things, as you can see from some of the documents I gave you.
So where were those threats from the general public or other groups?
National Front was much stronger then, still. Or it might have been called that. It might have been morphed into something else, but the National Front, broadly speaking. The National Fronts were very, very anti-Irish and quite often attacked Irish marches. They were obviously, but the general public as well. But interestingly enough, the only grant we never got through was one for Troops Out Movement, which was actually not an IRA front. It was, you know, people believing it should be night on, but that was the one grant that we could never get through a committee because of a huge amount of stuff in the papers.
So what grant was that?
To the Troops Out Movement, which campaigned for United Ireland, who were mainly Irish people, and that's the one grant we never got through. And there was huge outrage in the papers. But the other parts of the GLC, like the industry and employment, was a very progressive group as well.
And did you work closely with them, or were you
mostly? Only during the miners' strike, actually.
And what was that like?
That was good. It was the popular planning unit that I worked with. And I can't remember what. I think I worked with that because, quite apart from my work at GLC, myself and a guy, Narendra, who I mentioned before, wrote this pamphlet called A Million Jobs a Year. I think we promoted it with the popular planning unit. So that was coming at it from. There was also this other unit down in the basement, which is now the part of the aquarium, which I can't remember its name. It was like a community liaison team, and they're the people who organised all the festivals, and they went out and helped with community centres. They funded lots of projects still going, like the what's it called, the Hackney Empire, is a GLC project, because Ron did lots of the, say, the GLC campaigns. And his group were very, very active, and towards the end we helped them buy their building. And what I should say is, well, the programme officer I worked was also in charge of some of the big capital projects. So we would have been involved with some of those, like Coin Street, and buying quite a big property at the end for different community groups.
And many of those still community-led or owned today? Or?
Yeah, Coin Street. You know where Coin Street, all those restaurants are? Well, that, and behind there, that whole estate is community-owned and was given to them about 4 hours before the end of GLC. I remember it being signed. And then there are various, but some of them have gone under. Obviously, Hackney Empire is still there. There was the Irish Women's Centre, and certainly until very recently was there. But they just couldn't keep going. They couldn't get any grants to keep going. There's other bits and pieces around London which are buildings which the GLC gave to people, which obviously they owned. Mm.
So what were some of your kind of highlights or proudest moments working at the GLC?
I think the work around community inclusion, because it really was open door policy, so you'd have all kinds of people come into the building to have meetings, either with GLC councillors or with the community, from young people to old people, huge range. I think some of the work around policing and race is really important.
What did that look like?
It's difficult to explain, because when you saw those documents, we were talking about lots of ideas which has support amongst a small amount of lefties, but actually proved to be very popular with the people. The work around Ireland proved to be amazingly popular because of such a big Irish community who felt completely excluded and discriminated against. But also, a lot of the community festivals were a very good way of getting... One of the most popular things was the community festivals, because people felt that not only could they come together and celebrate, but they could also learn things. We'd have lots of stalls and things, so people quite often would pick up leaflets and stuff there. And... Yeah, it's a kind of trickle-down effect. But it was politically quite hard, because obviously it was... The GLC was embattled, which in some ways made it better. And certainly very few people I know who work at the GLC didn't really love it. It was exciting. But it was... I mean, Kennett never came to building. He never walked across that bridge. So it wasn't just the Tories. It was also the Labour Party hierarchy didn't like it. But most people who worked there really liked it. I'm including people who worked there previously. Because in the programme office, there were a few people who stayed for a while who were actual policy analysts, but nearly all the admin staff stayed, and they loved it. And they liked the excitement. And these are people who have been working there probably all their lives. Because many people in that video I lent you, they'll have come in as trainees and stayed the whole, because it was a place, in those days, people stayed in a job for life. So.
And how long did you stay there?
Until it got abolished.
So how long was that in total?
Probably about 2 years at GLC, but then there was a year and a half after at the London Strategic Policy Unit, because when the GLC was abolished, about 12 London boroughs took over the policy units for 2 years, which was very good, because it meant that we could finish some of our work up, sort out some of the groups. So that was not only women policing, it was also planning, there was about 8 different units, but I can't remember the others. And they worked very hard trying to, on legacy issues really, and passing work over to different boroughs.
Okay. So we'll circle back to legacy. So in terms of the GLC as an institution, what do you remember about kind of where power was situated or how decisions were made, or more about the formal and informal structures?
Well, as I say, they did accord the lawyers and the finance people. They didn't just override them, because it was such a, I mean, it had such a huge budget. It would have been ridiculous to do that, really. But Ken and John McDonald people obviously had a power, and there was a core group, I'd say about 20 councillors, who really led the way, because not just because they'd been selected by the Laypod, but also because they had the expertise in their particular areas. And then there'd be people like myself who were there. We'd have been called political appointees, I think, really, nowadays. We weren't particularly, we actually applied the jobs, but we were also experts in the areas they wanted to push forward. So, and certainly, it's quite hard for me to say, because I was kind of the centre of it, because I was, that policy unit was very central, so it's quite hard to tell what, most people I know really liked it, even people who were in more periphery parts. Because, I think I said, because of Croydon really, we had loads of money, because it had never been the intention to start some of these projects. Because one of the big priorities in the manifesto had been to make a fairer and cheaper public transport system. When Croydon took the GLC to court and the court stopped it, then we had billions of pounds. So the small scale, more radical programmes then could just expand.
And so what did that look like? Did it mean that, would you describe it as quite democratic in terms of each part having their own budgets?
Everybody had their own budget, and but people who spent more effectively got more money. I'm trying to think in our office. In our office, obviously, people, I think most committees began with a kind of equal amount of money for their function, but some people turn out to be much more efficient at curating things. Race and policing were very, well, on the policing side, there were already a lot of police monitoring groups all around London who we were funding, and other campaign groups about miscarriages. So, and the police unit was very well connected. It was very diverse. That's one of the things to say about that. There were a great diversity of race and gender in that, which meant they had better contacts outside. And the same was true of the race unit, very much so. So they were able to go out and find groups who would apply, not just their friends, but, you know, they were more, had more contacts. The women's unit had people applying, but I climb on to this, I always felt that they weren't as diverse, and certainly not by class, which meant that they weren't as careful. They funded a lot of projects that failed. And the other two units were much more strong in monitoring. So by the end, you know, people who were spending money effectively were getting more money.
So you mentioned already that the kind of senior Labour leadership and the Tories were very anti-GLC, but how did party politics play out internally from the people who were working there?
Oh, you mean most of the people who worked there, even the people who were probably Tories, enjoyed the work because they were given more responsibility. I was also a trade unionist, which gives you access to a wide range of people. So I was on the Joint Shop Stewards Committee. Go back to what shop stewards are. So it meant I was sitting on a body with firefighters, construction workers. And my impression from that was that there was a real interest in the work going on, and actually didn't perceive, unlike the new space, didn't perceive it as being a left Labour project. They perceived it as being a good project because they were able, like the firefighters, okay, some of them didn't like us putting, saying you had to have women and black people in the stations, but they did like the fact we put gyms in there and that we understood some of the stress they had. So there was, there were good things for them, even if they didn't like the women and black people. Yeah, housing, the Tories took housing away quite early on. I think other mainstream projects. Yeah, I mean, people applying for grants who weren't necessarily left Labour people, especially in the community events.
So it was kind of a cross party.
Yeah. But the Labour Party nationally didn't like it at all.
And how did that resistance manifest?
Well, lack of support, but it manifested. So when Thatch decided to close not just the GLC, she closed down Merseyside, whatever Manchester was called then. I think there were about five metropolitan authorities she abolished. We didn't get much support at all from the National Party in a campaign. The campaign was mainly run by Merseyside and London and the trade unions. And given it was going to thousands of people losing their jobs in those five places, they should have campaigned more. But apart from that, the repercussions happened later, actually, because the National Party really went for the London Labour Party later on and individuals. So most people who were active in what they see as the Londonette were, by fair means or foul, quite often foul, actually pushed off things like the National Women's Committee, the London Labour Party, partly because they changed the rules. Made it less representative. I think this one's slightly. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
So the repercussions, so what happened afterwards is in the years between abolition and 89, the National Labour Party managed to push out most of the London left off, certainly national or regional positions.
So was the resistance from the National Labour Party, was that, what was the basis for that? Was it ideological? Was it?
I would say it is ideological. They will, it's actually very, very similar to what's happening now. And a few of us are actually doing some research into what happened in the 70s and 80s. We're doing some research between 75 and 85. And it's, so now when people attack Jeremy, supposedly on organisational grounds, like he's not organised enough leader, actually it's not that at all. It's they don't like his international stance. They don't like his stance in Ireland. They don't like the fact he campaigned for Mandela. And that was very much the same. And these are some of the same people, of course, or their inheritors. And I think it was, because some of the things I really objected to was, for instance, because most of us at GLC were very internationalist, we'd have people, we had people from Grenada Revolution there, and we'd fly flags, like Palestinian flags or whatever flags, Nicaragua flags. And that used to really wind up the National Labour Party. So I don't think they've changed. And I actually think it isn't, they couldn't really object to community festivals. They couldn't really object to what we're saying about fairs. they probably did object to the work in policing race, but they would probably be more sensible to say so. They certainly objected locally, the right wing objected to the work we did in policing here in Islington on the grounds that we were colluding with criminals. ALNA remained a very difficult issue and does now, as you can see from what's said about Jeremy and the IRA. So I don't think it was, I think it was ideological.
Okay. So just to talk a little bit about the GLC as a workplace, can you remember what they did particularly to make it kind of a more equal workplace and how successful that was?
Well, interestingly enough, the old GLC had all these things which were, I think, were quite democratic, like, it sounds silly, but you had a day off a year to go on a works outing. You had a day off a year to go Christmas shopping. But people quite often went together. So you'd go, we went to France a few times with everybody in the office, including the secretaries and admin people, everybody. And in that way, it was quite equal. And as I say, the trade unions were across the board, so they weren't against each other. So you'd have the blue collar and manual workers unions and the office worker unions working very much together, which makes a difference. I don't remember there ever being any arguments about pay and things or conditions.
In terms of representation, like how well were minorities represented in terms of race and gender, sexuality? And
in the new units, very well. Firefighters, obviously not. Although there were lots, because I was involved in that, there were lots of the beginnings of things. And some of the stations were very helpful and some weren't. And that's taken a long time to make the firefighters different. Yeah, because I remember them voting against gay rights quite often. Things. So I'd say it's difficult to tell about. It would take longer to change the more established units, because obviously if you have a new unit, it's much easier to impose, or at least advertise more widely and work out what you're going to have. And also I think the new units were more, the qualifications they asked for were more wide-ranging. So and it also gave up, I was thinking there's two young guys, black guys, who were lawyers who worked in a police unit, and that was, I think, their first job. So they'd had some more experienced black lawyers come back from private practice. So that happened quite a lot at GLC, that to get things going, you'd get people in from universities or private practice to start things going. So we had some quite established lawyers in the police unit to start with. Then they went back to wherever they came from. But by that time, the younger people were more trained up.
So would you say it was a kind of concerted effort with the particular policies and practices put in place to bring in...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The personnel department, it wasn't called personnel. Well, the personnel department had a lot of strict policies about interviewing. We probably did much more equal opportunity interviewing than other people. Although people at Islington were still doing that then. I mean, they were doing it quite strongly. But I would say that it probably took a lot longer to make the teaching profession more diverse, just because people weren't even getting into the training. Although ILEA had some good in London Education Authority, which lasted slightly longer than GLC. It has some very good policy and diversity. But actually its core employees weren't as diverse.
Okay. And I know you mentioned previously the community festivals and things. And so you were a big part of organising them and attending them. And
yeah, I was involved partly because of other connections, as well as Yeah, we gave money from our unit, but also, yeah, I was quite involved in the FLA, which was up here at Fenty Park, which is a big Irish festival, which I don't know whether we, how much we funded, because that was done by an Irish promoter. I think we did give money to it, but we didn't have to give that money to it, much money to it, but so many others we did. And one of the most successful one, which actually been going before the GLC, was the one in Wandsworth Trades Council. It always had this little one in Battersea Park, and it became huge during the GLC, and it was very good. And one of the main guys who ran it, Melvin, is now the guy who runs Festival Republic, you know, runs all the huge festivals all over Europe. That's where he started.
And which are there any other big celebrations you remember, so the 95th anniversary or the Thames Day or things like that?
I don't remember Thames Day, but I do remember the last day, which was massive. Huge, not really celebration. Then there were lots of, there was that some people were walking from, most of the big things were actually demonstrations of one sort, that like people would walk from Newcastle. There's a big celebration at the GLC. I remember a nurses one, which ended up, because the GLC had all this space, because then we didn't have, I didn't like the Millennium Wheel, they didn't have the wheel, they didn't have all that other rubbish. So there was huge space by the GLC, which made it was a very useful place for people to march to. So most big marches ended up there, and then they'd have music. And I remember Ken on stage with, what's his name? He's a very depressive 80s actor. I mean, actor, singer. Anyway, Ken looked quite uncomfortable. But not as uncomfortable. I saw him another one. He, at a fundraiser, he had introduced this Irish punk band in a club up in Wollaston. It was a campaign that Ken supported, but he was obviously fairly, because there's all these bouncing Irish punks, and Ken got off stage as quickly as possible. But so, and I do remember the last one. The last bit was very sad, the last day, last night.
So, discussing that, when did you first learn that the GLC was going to be abolished?
Well, I think the Tories had been threatening it for about 3 years. Because it was a year's delay. So it must have been at least, the legislation must have been at least 2 years before abolition, because at one point there was a year's reprieve. So I think they probably started talking about 3 years before. So practically from the beginning they started about abolishing it. And of course, along with the abolition, lots of the, I mean, it was very hard on people who depend on the services. And people, some of the communities felt they'd been validated by GLC, definitely were upset by abolition, because they saw it as a attack on their community as well.
And so were you involved in the anti-abolition campaign?
Yeah. That video I gave was part of that. Things kind of merged into each other a bit, because of my role in the London Labour Party and working there. So sometimes I can't remember why I was there. But a lot of political activists work in GLC, so we probably wouldn't make distinction between what was our job and what wasn't our job.
And what did the campaign look like for you?
Well, it built on a community which we'd been working with, had a lot of theatre and music people involved. It was pretty localised. I know, as I say, there is this guy, his name's going back to me, the guy from Hackney Empire. He was very active, and he went round his group, who were kind of theatre come music group, were sent round to the boroughs that we didn't think had a strong local organisation. But it's pretty tactically planned. Mm. I think GLC was very popular. Mm. And certainly part of things like the Daily Mail. I can't think of anybody who really wanted Thatcher and the London, well, National Labour Party, who wanted it closed, really.
Were there points where you thought that it might not be, that the campaign might win?
No. The numbers were against us. I mean, at the beginning they were hoping that the GLC would pull back, I think, because there was, and probably had before that, on top of the roof of the GLC there was this big board saying how many people are unemployed, which faced straight onto Parliament. That was only one of the many things. So they had this this visual opposition across the Thames and them. But the GLC was never going to pull back. Why would they really?
So what do you, you've touched on it a few times, but what are your strongest memories of the last few months?
Being extremely tired. We had a lot to do because we were trying to protect people's jobs and also the services. And we still had a lot of money. So in our unit, we were charged with spending the money productively. And also I was on the Joint Shop Sales Committee. So it was a kind of pincer movement, I think I said before. So I might have got this slightly wrong, but I think if a London borough agreed to take, and we divided the remaining people up, like from architects down to gardeners, and put them in packages and said, okay, if you take this package of people on the same terms and conditions, which was quite easy because most people in local government had the same terms and conditions, I think some of the GLC people might have had slightly better terms and conditions, and I think that was one of the bargaining points. But we give you 10 million that you can spend in your housing. And everybody took it, as far as I'm, except for Hackney. So Islington got another 10 million.
And why didn't Hackney take it?
I, to this day, don't know. They didn't like the fact they hadn't interviewed the workers, which was a bit beside the point, really. Because they were getting this money, which they desperately needed for their housing, because their housing was rubbish. And they were getting pretty skilled workers from an organisation which was very good in employment, right? So it was, Hackney did take, they were on the left, they did take the funny positions. Mm. And that was Andrew Puddifat, who you might have come in contact with, who works in various kind of groups now, like he used to work at Justice. And so I don't know why he did that. And most other people who moved worked there for quite a long time and wherever they went to. In fact, a friend of mine has worked in architect Islington ever since. But so it was quite successful, and so nobody got compulsory redundant. A few older people chose to take voluntary redundancy. Like one of the guys on that video, I thought he was old. I don't think he probably was that old. And he decided to sail around the world. It seemed a good thing for him, so. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned that there was a kind of party slash, I don't know, I guess wake afterwards. What was that like?
It was massive, and it was quite strange, because actually we were still working, a lot of us. Certain officers were still signing cheques to people like Coin Street. And people were taking things out of the building because, for instance, the police unit, why the police unit has such good archives is that Paul Boateng signed everything over to us at the last minute, so we could remove all the records out of the building. Now, some other people didn't manage to do that or didn't think about doing that. So some of the other units, they've kind of lost all their research. I mean, some of it went off to LSPU, and that was safe. But then after that, it all kind of evaporated. As I say, women's unit stuff end up in somebody's attic. which is a pity because people might want to look at it. I think the ratio that stuff went somewhere, I can't remember where. And I don't, I'm sure Hillary took the public planning stuff places.
And so what are your, any specific memories of the final night celebrations?
It wasn't really celebrated. I remember it was, they were playing films against one end of the building, I remember that. There were lots of bands. But as I say, we were working half the time, so I don't really remember it that well. And then we all moved, well, LSBU started, we must have had somewhere to move to, so we, I think we started straight away. So in terms of the policy, it was kind of sort of seamless. And we were working with London councils we knew well, so it actually was quite an easy handover. But after 2 years, the money ran out. So.
And how, in the immediate aftermath of abolition, how did that feel for you? I know you were still working, but did it feel different to before? Or?
It's difficult to explain the 80s. The 80s is an incredibly crowded decade. And because what I found talking to younger people is that because most young people are more used to a single issue campaign perspective. In the 80s, there were single issues, but people were involved in a load of different things. So although the GLC was a very important part of the 80s, it was just part of things that's happened in the 80s. So there was all the work on Night Islands, all the work on the miners' strike. So the miners' strike was over by then, wasn't it? Yeah. Yeah, the miners' strike had finished. There'd be lots of other campaigns going on. So quite often, if you are someone like me, it's difficult to actually... It just was, we were very busy. We were... Where was I then? I'd moved to Hackney by then. So we were probably involved in local stuff as well. So it was... I'd say it was probably worse for the people who'd worked there all their lives. Because we saw it as part of our political activity to work there. And people went back to academia, they went back to where they'd been. I stayed at this policy place for 2.5 years. It probably affected some of the councillors quite badly, the ones who didn't stay involved. See, a lot of them did stay involved. Well, Mike Ward's the person I forget about. Mike Ward, the London Enterprise Board, stay game for a while, and he was chair of that. Valerie Wise didn't do much after GLC, but obviously people like John McDonald did. And quite a lot of people like Steve Bundy went into local government as an employee. So most of the leading councillors probably were still active afterwards.
So looking back on the GLC now, how do you feel about its significance or importance, and have those feelings changed at all over recent decades?
No, I think it was a very important, it would have been very good if it had gone on, because it really brought together trade unionists, activists, academics, councillors in a very productive manner, and I think it could have gone to do much, much better things as well. And it was a real waste, some of the loss of expertise and the fact that people were just rewriting. And unfortunately, the GLA wasn't a success to GLC. For instance, their police committee has never ever asked anything from the police unit. So they haven't learned from anything, any research, anything. And I don't think that the race advisor at GLA learned anything from Herman. He could have learned those things, but he didn't. So that was a bit of a pity that there was no connection apart from Ken. Because Ken's people around him weren't people who'd worked the GLC. Well, there was a few people in GLA who had worked the GLC, but not the core people. And it was a very different organisation and very small and didn't have much money.
And so how did the kind of, what kind of lasting impact did the GLC have on London's communities?
Well, I think it had a huge effect, particularly on the Irish and Black community, because it did validate them. And it's quite hard to explain from now, because later on, was very shortly after that, at the NDAs I worked in Ealing, and I worked as a community development officer. I did some work with some Irish women who were kitchen staff and people like that. And I was talking to them, and they was, because they were Irish, and I was talking to them, and they said that before the GLC, they'd always felt really afraid of going anywhere except for the Irish club. And they'd felt beleaguered. And they said since the GLC, they had a much better ability to, you know, express themselves. And I've heard Black people say the same thing, because the support for theatres and theatre groups, although it was not that expensive, did actually highlight people. And quite a lot of the theatre groups survived. And also some of the policies. I mean, policies that they thought we were stupid on, like we funded Gay's the Word, this gay man's bookshop, and also one in Islington called Sister Right. And that got a huge amount of adverse publicity, but of course it's commonplace now. Mm. The same as lots of issues. I mean, some of the things the police say now are things that we were saying about the police. So a lot of things which the GLC said, people think are completely ordinary now. They certainly didn't at the time.
So would you say that there are lasting cultural impacts?
Yeah. And policy impacts in terms of diversity and that side. Because, of course, the GLC couldn't do much about housing or... you'd have to ask on you. I think Ilya, the education wing, did have some impacts. But, of course, that was all lost when they got abolished. Because what they were good at, Ilya, was... Then Ilya was based on the inner London boroughs. And obviously some were much poorer than others. And they were very good at trying to compensate for that and actually putting specialist teachers into the poorer boroughs or giving more money to Hackney or to Hammers. Of course, that all went when they got abolished. Yeah.
So looking back, what would you say are kind of the biggest successes or failures of the GLC?
I think biggest successes were democratising, giving people entry. People thought they had ownership. So they thought, and they did come in the building, and they did come to big meetings. And it wasn't just political people. It was pensioners and things like that. And yeah, lots of the ideas came from below, not above. Obviously, there were policies and manifestos, but most of the councillors are very keen on people actually giving them ideas and trying to process those ideas. Not all of them, but most of them.
And the failures?
Failures? Well, I don't think we have enough time to fail. it's interesting because when people attack the GLC, it's difficult to see what they say as failures. They'll probably tell you that they spent too much time on minorities, which wasn't actually true. I know, because I've seen the budget. It wasn't, you know, we spent a lot of minorities, but it's just because nobody else was doing it. But the bulk of the budget was going to what it always went on. And there were lots of, I suppose, when we talked about transport, I wasn't very involved in the transport policies. The transport policies were quite progressive, even the ones which weren't successful. Well, I suppose Fares Fair was a failure.
And what was that, Fares Fair?
Well, this is why I have this money, because I think it's called Dave Wetzel had this idea, and I think the London Labour Party also, that it was a bit like an early version of the Oyster card. It wasn't quite sophisticated, that you could, which was going to benefit people by having kind of a, bringing the overall fares down. It was ironic because actually Croydon, who opposed it, probably the people in Croydon probably would have benefited from it more people had to travel a long way. And that got blocked by the courts, so that never happened. But apart from that, very few things, apart from being abolished, are really blocked.
So what do you think would have happened if the GLC hadn't been abolished?
I think we'd have gone on developing policy really well. There would have been less money because we wouldn't have had a windfall from Fairs Fair. So we probably wouldn't be able to expand the grants program as much. But on the other hand, some of the groups who kind of didn't succeed, well, that's not surprising when people don't always succeed. What I don't know politically is that obviously at the end of the 80s, with Kinnock, there was a real division that Kinnock caused in the Labour Party. Now, I don't think that would affect the GLC because there was an accommodation between the different people. I mean, all of them weren't as left-wingers. In fact, there's probably a minority who were actually left-wing on the council, on the Labour group, but they were much better organised. So I don't think it really would have affected them, but who knows, you know, in another GLC election you might have got people elected who weren't sympathetic. But I think the actual policies and policy development would have gone on.
So what are some of the positive elements of life in London today that are part of the legacy of the GLC?
Well, I think the openness. I mean, compared to the rest of the country, London is, well, if we discount people like Croydon, there's a much more openness about race, which I think has something to do with what was said during the GLC time. If you step outside London, people's attitudes are much worse. And because you have to work, you can't. I mean, I'm critical about New Labour because I think we could see it coming in the Northern Heartlands, that people were blaming black people or European people. And it should have been challenged. It was let go. And the GLC did challenge people like that. And it worked. So quite often people challenge, they back down because, I mean, Rock Against Racism was a very interesting experiment or group because they did regularly challenge the white racist youth. And the white racist youth quite often backed down. And once they saw the music and they thought they were fun and tough, they usually turned over to Rock Against Racism. So, but you can't, if you leave, it just festers. So I think that's a major legacy. And I think the policies have trickled down, partly because individuals have taken them elsewhere, and also some councils have taken them elsewhere.
Would you say there are any negative impacts of the GLC in London today?
Not really, because without a London authority, one is a meaningful one, and the GLA is there, but I don't think it's really got the power to do much. London has become more unequal, really. London, it's difficult to say, because London is very mixed, and Islington itself was very mixed. But I think since in the old boroughs like Tower Hamlets and Newham, one bit further out, were always not only questionable about racism, they're also questionable about corruption. Unfortunately, Newham is still very corrupt on the Labour Party Council. And the GLC was tackling that really because when you had councils coming together, they could say to each other, no, you can't do that. Whereas being left themselves, they are doing that. So, I'm quite shocked what's been happening in Newham, which is exactly what's happening in the GLC, and we had to fight against it. So that's another good thing about having a coordination across a city. You can actually try and persuade people to be better than they are.
So lots of a part of the reason for this project is because lots of younger people in particular don't know about the GLC, what it was or how it worked. Why do you think that's the case?
Partly because part of the reason for abolishing it was to close down what it was doing. It was ideological. It wasn't posing any electoral threat to the Tories, but it was posing ideological threat because there was no threat from Kinnock, really. Kinnock didn't really oppose, in the same way as Blair didn't really oppose. They had sound bites and they had little arguments over the, but they didn't actually oppose, and that's what the Tories wanted to close down. They closed it down. So what's the beginning of that question?
So just lots of young people don't.
Oh yeah. And I'm quite surprised that they don't. But then you did enter the 80s, not say 90s, which was very individualistic. And I think there was a huge gap. And it's very obvious. It's very obvious in momentum. It's very obvious when you go on demonstrations. There's a missing generation, about 15 years worth of people. Like momentum, both here and I went to the momentum thing up in Liverpool. It was probably evenly balanced between young people, broadly speaking young people, and people broadly speaking my age. And there was nothing in the middle. And I think that's another reason why the tradition wasn't carried on, because the people who came in, and obviously the Thatcher really went for the London, and you left councils. And some of them did get surcharged. Lambeth got surcharged. Thousands of pounds, individuals. So I think what happened is that more left-wing councillors didn't go into councils. One, because they couldn't see any point, because they weren't going to be able to do things. And so the people going in weren't really sympathetic to GLC ideas, and they saw them as loony lefts.
And so what does it mean to you that it was forgotten or in some ways?
Well, I see it as part of the lurch rightwards. It's more interesting. The more interesting question is, what's happening now? Why has it suddenly come back? A significant amount of Jeremy's supporters, people about 55 and upwards. They're people who are affected by things like GLC, but it seems to me that the young generation suddenly, there's always been some young people, but they've usually been the children of people who were lefties, but suddenly there's loads of them, which is very interesting. It's interesting to know why.
So yeah, in terms of where we're at now, what are your kind of future hopes and concerns for where we go from here in light of the lessons from the GLC?
This is a whole book. It concerns me, and is that the undermining of Jeremy from the PLP people is very similar to the undermining of the GLC by Kinnock and people. And it's ideological. And it is also racist in some ways, because the big issues then were support for what were seen as people who wanted Ireland to leave the Union, and black people who took power in their own hands. Those are the two people that the mainstream Labour Party found very difficult to deal with. But nowadays it's also, race was a huge problem for the Blairites. And it was a big issue in Brexit, which wasn't dealt with properly by them. So it's into, I think, the same issues of coming up again. And just hopefully the Labour Party this time is more robust. And also, obviously, the membership's high, momentum's good. it's brought a lot of people back into party who know how to organise. But people do have this thing about leadership, which I think is old-fashioned concept. And they can't forgive Jeremy for his views on Ireland and internationally. But I don't think all is lost. The same with us. I mean, I'm not very pro-America, but I'm very encouraged by Bernie Sanders and the amount of people in America that seem to be taking action. I always just think America was a lost place, really.
Did you have anything else you wanted?
No, that's fine. That's good. Yeah, thanks.
Right. Just finishing.